you know, I wanted to start off with the basics in layman's terms, describing what this Energy Choice Amendment looks to do.
As I read the Energy Choice Amendment, it looks to create for the electric industry what was done decades ago with the telephone industry, and which was done in the 1980s, I believe it was, in the natural gas industry. And basically, it's called unbundling. It's called an unbundling of services. For natural gas, what was unbundled was utilities that previously hunted for the gas and secured the gas from the earth and then transported it to customers. It was unbundled so that they had to create different companies where one company actually searched for the gas and got it out, and then a separate company acting independently had to transport that gas to a customer for the customer's use. So the second company was marketing the customer and doing the retail sales to customers. And basically what happened there was it gave the end-use customer a choice to go look for different gas providers around the country. And that is the long and short of what this amendment is intended to do. It is intended to unbundle the act of generating power, the act of electricity, and unbundle that from the act of selling it to a consumer.
So on its face, consumer choice, you know, always kind of sounds like a good thing. But, you know, opponents kind of point to Texas as a state that's done essentially the same thing, and they say rates have gone up. So, you know, help us wrap our mind around the mindset of the people who oppose this thing.
Well, let me start with if I were a proponent of this, if I was a proponent of unbundling, I would look at what happened in the telephone industry. I would look at what happened in and is happening in 18 states across the United States. And I would pick at and choose the developments that have happened that have worked to unbundle electric service, because it's happened already. And I don't know why there's not more emphasis and more analysis on what is happening over there to determine really, is it working? Ryan, I just wonder too, and again, I don't have any dog in this hunt. I'm not working for anybody in this regard. But I wonder whether or not the amendment is here a bit too soon, because I believe that distributed power, which is power that, if you just think about a solar panel on a home or a house, that's distributed power. There are a lot of fuel cell technologies being investigated. There are investigations now about whether you can have at your house equipment put into the ground to work with the thermal heat in the ground and actually produce power for yourself. That is the future. I think that will come. And this, if people knew that they could do that and it would be cheaper and they'd have their own source of power, I think they would be totally supportive of this amendment. However, we're not there. And that is not available to us, so the proponents of this can't suggest that it is. It's coming, though. I think if this amendment passed, it likely would come a lot sooner, because the amendment would force people to then eliminate barriers to the investigation of these other sources, potential sources of power. And I think money would flow to that, just like we've seen money flow to solar when things started to open up. In Florida, people know about water situation and the water scarcity. In parts of Florida decades ago that I worked with some utilities, they were doing reverse osmosis treatment. They were taking salt out of the water and producing clean water for people. It was unheard of then, but it's happening more and more in Florida, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper because people are now investing in those technologies. That's what would happen if this amendment passed today.
So, you know, all that said, do you think that the opponents, at least in the, you know, in the short term or in the immediate, do you think they have a point that it wouldn't be a consumer-friendly amendment?
Again, I would look to see what it did with telephone, and I would look to see what it did with natural gas. Having done utility rate making and represented utilities for quite some time, I do think that one concept hasn't been investigated yet, and that is when a utility, these investor-owned utilities, go before the Public Service Commission and they get their rates set, they are allowed a return on the investment that they make. And that's what they're trying to protect, the return that they make in these generating plants. The return they get is modulated by the PSC depending on risk. Is it risky to make that investment? And for years, the utilities have argued it is risky because there are regulatory risks and there are industry risks, and that is the risk they've been talking about is just this very fact, that technologies might come along that make them obsolete. So for years, they've been getting a higher return, 10, 12, 13, 15% return, because the PSC has recognized, you know, you're right, you're making a risky investment. Well, I think we should be looking at the fact that if that's the case, and they've been compensated in rates by customers all these years for a higher risk, if now that risk comes to pass, I don't know that we should be saying that the utility should be able to recover their what they call stranded costs, the costs in that generating plant, if they don't sell enough power to recover those costs, because now people can go buy power themselves. I think that's something that has to be looked at. And I think if I was a utility, I'd be concerned about that happening. But the question is, from the customer's perspective, have we been paying all along to compensate them for that risk that they've been taking?